2014 marks 60 years since the landmark Supreme Court decision known as Brown v. Board. The High Court declared state laws establishing separate public schools for black and white students unconstitutional. While the ruling had an undeniable effect on public education, many school systems, some here in Maryland, remained resistant to allowing black and white children to learn together. In this hour of midday, the story of a family's fight for the integration of a high school in Harford County in 1959 and 1960. Our guest was the first black student to enter Aberdeen High School. From there, A. Dwight Pettit went on to become a prominent Baltimore attorney. Dwight Pettit joins us today to talk about his legal career and the father whose lawsuit helped launch it. First, the news. And welcome back to Midday, our second hour. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. In the timeline of the civil rights movement in the United States, one of the most pivotal moments in establishing equality for African Americans came 60 years ago with the landmark 1954 Supreme Court ruling in Brown v. Board, in which the separate but equal doctrine was struck down by the Supreme Court. While the ruling had an undeniable effect on public education, many school systems remained resistant to allowing black and white children to learn together. Here in Maryland, in Harford County, it took the work of an engineer and Aberdeen Proving Ground employee named George Pettit to establish equality in the public schools there. He filed a lawsuit against the Board of Education of Harford County after his son, Dwight Pettit, was denied the chance to attend Aberdeen High School, on the premise that he had a, quote, lack of ability and low achievement. But through the legal work of Thurgood Marshall, who litigated Brown and the Harford County case, A. Dwight Pettit was admitted to the school, and he excelled. This experience, witnessing the power of litigation in a changing world, forever changed that young student, who went on to become a prominent attorney here in Baltimore, and he is my guest this hour. Baltimore attorney A. Dwight Pettit has handled several high-profile cases over a four-decades-long legal career that has spanned from the civil rights case I just described to his own practice here in Baltimore, so we have a lot to talk about. A. Dwight Pettit decided to write a biography, a story about all of this, called Under Color of Law, The Story of an American Family, a self-published book, but give us an opportunity here to talk to Dwight Pettit about this very interesting case in Harford County from 1959-1960. Dwight, it's nice to have you on the show.
Dan, it's really my pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for doing this book. It opened my eyes to something I hadn't really thought about very much, because we all know that the day that Brown was decided, certainly all the doors did not open for African-American students around the country. It took a while. And Harford County resisted this for a good while, and they had something called a Blue Ribbon Commission, right?
Right.
To decide whether African-American students would be admitted to their schools.
Well, each student had to apply, Dan. And you had to go through this assessment by this Blue Ribbon panel as to whether they would admit you or deny you admission.
Let's step back a little bit. Your family started off in North Carolina, right?
Yeah, my mother and father from North Carolina. My dad home in the Great Rocky Mountains there, right by the Tennessee border. In fact, just like the Waltons, my father's family lived on top of the mountain. And my mother was in a place called Relifton, North Carolina. And so my dad, his family had basically gone to Antioch College at the time. And so he and his one sister and he had 10 brothers, six of those went to Antioch, and they helped each other through Antioch College. And my dad graduated and went on to teach calculus and higher mathematics at North Carolina Central College at the time, which was not too far from Greensboro.
That was an all-black college.
All-black also. And then he was driving a truck in the military and all, and he was very fortunate to be one of the first or the first African-American hired here at Fort Holabird in the area of Dundalk, and we lived in Turner Station. And at one point in time, his division, Ballistic Research Laboratories, transferred to Aberdeen, and I'm at that time in the seventh, eighth grade at Solace Point, having a good life, playing a little sports, elected May Day king of the school, and learning to chase girls and having a ball. And at one time, and my dad comes in and says, guess what, son? We're going to Aberdeen, 30 miles north of Baltimore. And I'm like, Aberdeen, what? And I was devastated. And got out to Aberdeen. There was nothing out there but skunks and deer. And even though we lived on the military base, rabbits and what have you, and a whole new world. I was taken out of the Turner Station, which I had loved
which
to learn.
Which was all black neighborhood.
All black neighborhood, and all of a sudden thrust into practically an all white neighborhood, all white world.
You were on the base. You were on Aberdeen Proving Ground
base.
Your father was employed by the Army?
Yes, he was a GS-11 at the time and was engineer for the Army.
Okay.
And he not.
Were there any other black kids there?
It was a couple of military kids. We were the only civilians on the base, as I recall. At that time, civilians could live there with the military personnel if you were of a certain rank in terms of civilian life.
So, Dwight, the time check then, what year is that? So you're an eighth grader.
It's 1958.
It's 58. It's 4 years after Board,
mm-hmm.
Brown versus Board. So your father is well aware of Brown versus Board. Are you aware of it as an eighth grader? Can you remember if you...
I'm not aware of it. My father's aware because he just pulls up to... Says, you know, son, there's a black school here, or at that time a Negro school. And there's a white school. Well, to be quite honest with you, Dan, the only thing that I was driven by, I was really into athletics, and I had gone over by the black school. They didn't have any I didn't see anything that looked like a goalpost. And when we passed Aberdeen High School, there was a goalpost, which means there had to be a football team. And I wanted to play football.
Okay, so you're in the eighth grade.
Right, coming into the ninth.
But Aberdeen High School is a choice. They're the ones, that's the school with the goalposts.
Right.
What was the other choice? What was the
Havre de Grace Consolidated was the so-called quote-unquote colored school, and they also had another school in the area up near Bel Air by the name of Central, which was also the Negro school. So most black people, all black people, really went to those particular two schools. My father said, "Dwight, do you want to go to Aberdeen?" I said, "Yes, Daddy." He said, "Well, son, let's go in." He had no idea that when he walked in. That we were going to be checked at the office and say, wait a minute, we don't allow Negroes like that. There's an application process. We have a stair-step desegregation plan, and at this point in time, no Negro males were in the school.
Okay, so fact check on this. There's no application process for white students.
No. White schools
right?
are obviously
public school
admitted.
Right, okay.
And the only thing I would correct you on, if I may, Dan, at this point in time, when my father does go to the NAACP and secures attorneys, Thurgood Marshall is the national attorney for the Legal Defense Fund,
right.
NAACP. But Juanita Jackson Mitchell
took your case.
Is the local attorney that takes the case.
Oh, okay.
And along with a local attorney by the name of Tucker Dering. And also on the pleadings is a lawyer of great stature, Jack Greenberg, who would go on to, who also argued all the major desegregation. So I ended up with a star-studded legal defense
case. You did. I'll get to that in a minute. So first, the decision to file suit. So your father goes to the school not knowing that there's this application process. He assumes he can just enroll his son, A. Dwight Pettit, who wants to play football, at Aberdeen High School.
Exactly.
And he's told he's going to apply.
Right.
So did he do that?
Well, he went and made the application, and I have all the records where he fought through the whole Harford County school system where they denied my applications, and he appealed, and he then wrote letters into the Sun, and he wrote letters to the state and so forth, the state school board, and all of those things were denied. So we exhausted all the administrative procedures before going into federal court. Went into federal court, and the judge was Chief Judge Roselle Thompson of the Maryland U.S. Federal District Court. And so we went in, and here we are with this high-powered a battery of lawyers, and my father decided that he wanted me to keep up academically. He was the academician in the family, and he felt that he enrolled me in the black school because he had to, Havre de Grace Consolidated. So I did go there for the eighth grade, but he decided that the curriculum there was the same as the curriculum I had at Solace Point. Was really 2 years behind Solace Point. He decided that therefore I was going backwards instead of forward. So he made a bold decision, a bold and expensive decision. And also he had become vice president of the NAACP by then.
Okay, so he was very active.
He was active.
Okay, but here's the thing that impressed me about that. It wasn't like Thurgood Marshall and locally Juanita Jackson Mitchell said, go find us a test case for Harford County.
Oh, no.
Your father went,
to them, right?
He said, there's something wrong here. It's 4 years after Brown.
Mm-hmm.
My son wants to go to this school. And he thought the academics would be better there.
Yes, exactly.
And you could play football.
And right, but his main thing was the academics. He wasn't concerned about football.
Right.
I was concerned about football.
Yeah, that was your thing. Right. That and girls, right?
And girls. Right.
Okay, so 1958, you're an eighth grader. 1959 comes. What happens in that year?
Well, he makes the bold decision, Dan, to send me, to keep me at par and in parity. He sends me back to Baltimore and takes up the expenses of paying the Baltimore City School Board for me to enter here into the ninth grade at LaMelle Junior High School, which was just opening at the time. And he boarded me out in Baltimore. So he said, you know, son, this is going to be tough, but you're going to travel to Baltimore. I'm going to take you to Baltimore every weekend, 30 miles away. I'm going to put you with another family, and you're going to attend school. And I'm going to provide tutors for you, and you're going to have tutors in Spanish, algebra, mathematics, everything. And he set all of that up and paid for it out of his income, which was, you know, at that time quite meager.
Who did you live with? Do you remember?
Yes, it was a family by the name of Hollingsworths. And they were just a dynamic family. The house was right there on Ruxton Avenue, right behind Douglas High School. So the game plan was, if we lost the case, I was going to go to City or Douglas.
Douglas.
But if we won, then I would be entered into Aberdeen High School. So I finished LaMelle and was ordered into Aberdeen High School.
So, okay, well, we'll get to that order in a minute. Now, so you spent ninth grade at LaMelle?
At LaMelle.
Okay. Then you get this case. It's Judge Thompson hears the case.
Mm-hmm.
It's argued Harford County loses.
Yes.
They lose quickly? I mean, this is a long, drawn-out process, or was it a pretty quick decision by the court?
He makes a major decision, and he issues in the book, I quote his opinions. He basically rules, Dan, that the schools are separate and unequal, and therefore it's not inviolative of Brown, but it's inviolative of equal but separate, the decision, Plessy versus Ferguson.
Right.
And based on that, I'm ordered into the school. And he says in the opinion, which I quote in the book, you know, young man has been attacked for this, but he's been living by himself. He's been living with a family in Baltimore, and he's still achieved. He survived in federal court during the trial. He became president of his class. I'm chief judge of the school court. So he has earned the right to enter Aberdeen High School, and if he doesn't come up academically, he has a right to fail. That's what the judge rules.
Wow.
And orders me under Plessy versus Ferguson, more so than Brown versus Board, into Aberdeen High School.
For the 1960
school year.
Right. A. Dwight Pettit is our guest here, and we'll talk about his experience when he entered Aberdeen High School. So you were going to be the first black student there, first African-American student to enter?
Well, as it would be, I think a black female had been admitted also by court order just before me.
Okay.
And when I made the application process and them trying to deflect the litigation, they ordered another black female into the school also.
Okay.
But I would be the first black male entering into Aberdeen High School.
Well, we'll take a break here and pick up more of this local history from the life of A. Dwight Pettit, Baltimore attorney, who's written a book about this experience of integration of the public schools in Harford County, but also about his legal career here in Baltimore, which has been pretty rich and pretty busy, spending time with us in this hour of midday. A short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here, spending this hour with A. Dwight Pettit, Baltimore attorney, who decided to write a book about his very interesting life. And we started off with this case in Aberdeen. So you're the test case. You later become an attorney, but here you are, 15 years old?
Right, 14.
Yeah, 14, involved in a case to integrate the public high school in Aberdeen, Maryland. And Thurgood Marshall actually did come to Maryland,
mm-hmm.
and he did argue your case.
Yeah, but he was initial attorney, and he was lead attorney for the NAACP. And my law partner later on, Michael Mitchell, would tell me, because I was so busy involved in school and trying to be prepared for the trial. But Michael tells me later, he says, Thurgood got into a thing with Chief Justice Roselle Thompson in court, where they went back and forth, and it got to be very, very aggressive argument, to the fact that Thurgood walked out and said, Juanita, you got to argue this case. I can't deal with this man.
He deferred to Juanita Jackson Mitchell.
Right. That's what I was told.
You mentioned the other counsel were Tucker During.
Tucker During, who was a big lawyer in Baltimore City.
And Jack Greenberg.
And Jack Greenberg, who was also would become a national director of the Legal Defense Fund for the NAACP.
Right. Wow. You did have an all-star lineup there. And won the case.
Right.
So you had got the right to enter Aberdeen High School in 1960 as a sophomore? You would have been a sophomore.
I went into my sophomore year, my 10th grade year.
So before we go there and you tell us about that experience, I wanted to hear a little bit more about your father, who sounds like a remarkable guy. You use the word arrogant to describe him, but I think in a positive way.
Yes, in a very positive way. I'd use it in the highest form that I can imagine. My father was very, very defiant. He was a very, very brilliant man. I know I'm in some way biased because he was my father, but I've been around a lot of individuals, and I had never been around. Very few times I remember being around somebody that smart, that dynamic, and that academic. He was totally, I guess you might say, hostile to a certain extent because, as I mentioned in the book, he even tried to be a Tuskegee Airman, but he was before his time, and he was turned down, and he wrote his memoirs about that. And when he was drafted in the military, he was sent to England during the bombing, but he was still protesting about not being allowed to be a pilot. Hmm. And he wrote memoirs and letters and was going to bring suit and so forth. His brother was killed in Europe, Ray Pettit. And at the time, he was in England, so he was totally rebellious even when he was in the military because he felt as though he was being kept down at a certain level because of his race when he was really gifted and had the ability to do much higher things.
Okay, so you got a job with the Army, though, as an engineer.
Right.
Pretty good job. That's what brought you to Maryland and to Aberdeen Proving Ground.
Right.
Did he tell you, do you remember conversations with your father when you were 15? Who said, you know, we're going to go through this case, we're going to test this case, and if we win, you got to go to Aberdeen High School, and that might be very challenging for you.
You raise a very good point, because being vice president of the NAACP, Dan, the word went out when we won the case for other blacks who wanted to go. So my father...
You mean who was vice president? Your father?
My father.
Of the Maryland chapter?
Maryland chapter of the NAACP. Vice president, if I didn't say that.
You said that.
So he went through the community trying to recruit other African-American kids and families to join me, and since the suit had just about knocked down the walls of segregation. And a lot of parents and most of the kids said, no, we don't, Mr. Pettit, we don't want to deal with that because we got jobs, we got careers, but most of all, our kids will be subjected to a very hostile environment, and we don't want to put our children through that. We don't know whether they're going to be protected, whether they're going to be received with violence and what have you. So he came back to me. He said, Dwight, it looks like it's you. Son, this is a big challenge. You think you're tough enough to take it on? He said, you don't have to do this. We won the suit, but you don't have to put yourself in jeopardy unless you feel as though you want to do it and you can handle it. And so that was the discussion that we had.
So you decided, I'm going to go to Aberdeen.
I want to play football.
I want to play football. So you went in there for your sophomore year.
Yes.
Yeah. So what was that like?
Well, for me, it wasn't bad because I was really blessed. My daddy called the principal and told me, the principal, that I wanted to play football and I was going to come out. But I was blessed with a tremendous coach. It was a man by the name of Jim Smith. He was a former Marine, a war hero. He was everything that you might see in American folklore as a football coach. And he laid it out to the team very quickly and very openly that I was going to play on that team. And if anybody called us all to the back of the football field behind the goalpost, and if the kids didn't like it, anybody didn't like it, he used the first few choice words. If they didn't like it, they could get the hell out of there right now. That I was going to play football and I was going to play on that Aberdeen High School football team.
Did you know that was coming? Did you know that the coach was going to say
total
that?
Total surprise. Total surprise, because I had
played. Did the coach welcome you individually onto the team?
No, I had played junior varsity, and nobody had said much. I did the dumb thing of Dan going out for quarterback at a time that was unheard of. But other than that episode, which I learned that I wasn't going to be able to play quarterback, but otherwise, when Coach Smith made that statement, that froze everything in terms of the athletic situation.
I'm trying to think of that for a minute. It's 1960. Okay, it's 6 years after Brown v. Board, but still, the coach speaks up for you without saying a word to you, so you didn't know that was coming.
Mm-mm. And it was a total surprise.
And did anybody walk?
No, nobody walked. I had already gotten into a fight. Well, I got into a fight with one of the kids, and I was very fortunate. I was able to knock the kid out. And so that sort of arrested all the physical apprehensions.
What, that was the only incident you had like that?
He was supposed to be one of the tough guys in the school. I was very fortunate. Caught him with a lucky punch. My father and all of us backed out of the parking lot, and everybody was there, the football teams, the parents and all, because it was after practice, and the parents would come up and pick up the kids, the varsity, junior varsity. So everybody in the school saw it.
What set off the fight?
Basically, I threw a towel at a buddy of mine that I'd befriended, or a friend that had befriended me, and my friend ducked, and the towel hit this kid who was, I think, called himself representative of the mood of the school, that he was going to put the end in his place. And so he came over to me and said, well, you got two choices. You can leave now, or you can become the towel boy for the school. And every day you can be on the team, but you got to pick up the towels and do whatever we tell you to do. And I basically told him that wasn't going to happen. And so I was very fortunate. And once I did that, the next day I reported to class, and the hallways opened up like the Red Sea. You know, all the kids were speaking, and everybody was friendly. And being an athlete,
so they didn't think your punch was lucky. They thought, just
right,
better watch out
this
for Dwight.
This kid can fight.
Or, I mean, was they afraid? What are you saying about that? Were they afraid of you, or were they just say, did you get instant respect?
I got instant respect. The kid that I had fought was, you know,
I'm curious about
well
this.
Received.
Do you think the kids at Aberdeen were ready for black students, generally speaking, or was it a, I wouldn't call it a friendly environment, or they just said, hey, you know, this is going to happen. What would you say about the general feeling in the school?
Well, let me explain something about Aberdeen, what makes Aberdeen different. Dan, you know, that's the school that Cal Ripken came out of,
right,
and a lot of other notable people. It was different than other schools because the school, half of the population was a military base. And so you had half of the population which were home people or the local people who might have had more racial anxieties. But the military kids had traveled all over the world. And so you had kids that were used to different races and so forth and befriended me very easily. And the other kids who might have been resistance sort of came across as I began to show off my athletic prowess.
You had kids there whose parents, whose dads might have gone through World War II.
Right.
Through the Korean War.
Been in Germany, been right in Europe. And
the integration
Korea
of the Army.
Right.
Which is the 1948, right?
Right. So I was entering the most hostile thing that I had to deal with was more so the faculty and the administration of the school, not particularly the kids. Hmm. When they found out I could play ball, and what have you. And, you know, I have some emotional things in the book, games that I won and so forth. The kids received me tremendously. I was
What position did you play?
I played offensive and defensive end. And, you know, I talk about it in the book when I was down at Wicomico High School. But, you know, people don't realize that was the Eastern Shore. Wicomico High School was just like Mississippi.
That was the South.
That was the South. We didn't have any blacks on. If any blacks were in the stadium, it was my mother and father and the people who cleaned up the stadium. Well, I was fortunate enough to catch, intercept, and win the game with the winning touchdown. And was basically carried off by my student body and the band and the cheerleaders, and I think they carried me off because I took my helmet off, and the stadium sort of went into a hush when they realized that I was black. But they got me on the bus and got me out of there. So for the kids in Aberdeen, I was more or less a student hero, where every place that we played, it was an anomaly because there was no other blacks there. And it was the same way with public facilities.
Right.
You got to remember, Dan, if we won a football game and we came off the field and wanted to go have a Coke at the ice cream parlor or something like that, when I walked in, it became integrated because all those places in Aberdeen or Harford County, Edgewood, were segregated.
Did you have trouble in those places? And do you remember specifically students chanting in any way towards you? Students on the opposing team, associated with the opposing school, chanting anything about your presence?
If I heard the N-word, you know, I was playing ball. So, you know, their observation of my presence was something that I really didn't get exposed to.
Hmm.
And when we were in Aberdeen, the places, the kids would be very vocal. Some places would come in and they'd say, Negroes are not allowed. And the students would say, if Dwight can't come in, nobody comes in. That was that type of thing.
Wow.
I was elected vice president of the Athletic Association. I was elected most popular. So with the kids, it became a very, very personal, favorable type of things. What my father, as you know in the book, my father was a different story.
Well, I want to ask you about that. I find this amazing. You ended up representing your father.
Right.
Because your father suffered consequences because of his activism in the NAACP and as a result of his involvement in your case,
basically,
or bringing your case. Right?
Basically for bringing the case.
Okay.
They told him he would never be promoted again. They put rebel flags up in his office. They played Dixie when they came to work. They referred to him as boy. They kicked us off the military base. So he really caught pure D hell.
A. Dwight Pettit is our guest. His book is Under Color of Law. We're going to ask him about the title of that book in a moment. The Story of an American Family is a subtitle. So your dad gets all this abuse really because he's standing up for you.
Exactly.
For your right to go into Aberdeen High School.
Right.
You go off to Howard University. You get a law degree. You go to work for the federal government for a while.
Small Business Administration.
As an attorney. At what point do you decide to bring a case for your father?
Well, my father's lawyer, he had gone back and gotten Juanita Jackson Mitchell again. And this time he was paying her. And it wasn't NAACP. It wasn't gratuitous. And she won everything in terms of the administrative aspects of the case. But Title VII, as it related to federal employees, had not been passed. So there was no law. When he won the case on the administrative level, the Department of the Army and the Civil Service said, okay, you won, and that the next available promotion, if you're qualified, you'll be promoted. Thank you, goodbye, and have a good life.
Explain Title VII to folks.
Title VII is when Congress passed the relief that you could get back pay and damages if discrimination was found to exist in the workplace to cause your terminational or lack of promotional opportunity.
Okay.
I'm laying in bed one morning in D.C. I'm working for the federal government, Small Business Administration, and I see a case in the paper called Teston versus the United States, where a case has been put in the United States Court of Claims for back pay on, Dan, the same thing that President Obama is arguing now, on executive orders. The case said the lawyer for the case was a man by the name of Paul Tagliabue, who would later become NFL commissioner. And the case was standing for the proposition that if you were found to have been discriminated against, you could be awarded back pay derivative from executive orders from Truman all the way up through Nixon.
So
you didn't have to have Congress.
You didn't need Title VII.
You didn't need Title VII.
So this is before Title VII.
This is before Title VII was applicable to federal employees.
Okay, so then Dwight, the young attorney, says,
I wake up. I wake my wife up, Barbara, and I call Paul Tagliabue on Monday. He says, son, come on down. And he tells me everything and says, you know, he finds it very amusing that this kid, he works for Covington & Burling, which is the largest law firm in the world and the most prestigious. And they've taken this as their pro bono work. And the case is set to go before the United States Court of Claims. I file Pettit versus the United States. I first have to go to the Nixon administration and ask for permission to litigate against the United States because I'm a federal employee.
This is, what, 1970?
This is 1970.
70, okay. Mm-hmm. So this is a full 10 years after you entered Aberdeen High School.
Right. Yeah. And so the federal government gives me permission, the Nixon administration, and I filed Pettit versus the United States in the United States Court of Claims. Well, some kind of way, the U.S. Court of Claims reaches down and takes my case for argument over Paul Tagliabue's case of Teston versus the United States. And all of a sudden, I get a notice that I am to argue in the United States Court of Claims across from the White House in front of 7 learned federal appellate judges, and they give me the date. I'm just knocked out. I can't believe it.
Wow. So how old are you then?
26 years old.
You're in your 20s, right? And you're arguing for your father.
Right. And the biggest first private case, and the biggest of my life.
Wow. Did you charge your father for the case? I'm kidding. So what happened when you went before the 7 learned judges?
We went before, and it was a vigorous argument, and we battled. My family was with me, my mother, my father, my wife, my secretary accompanied me. It's a huge court right across from the White House. And I came back to Baltimore. By then, I'd been admitted to the Maryland Bar. Came back to Baltimore and opened my practice with my law partner, Michael Mitchell. And one day, I'm coming out of court, and I see these trucks, reporters and all, running toward me, and like, what's up? And they, Mr. Pettit, you won. The Court of Claims just came down in a 4-3 decision, finding retroactive pay and ordering that you monitor the whole subsequent proceeding in terms of your father getting relief. Now, what the case did
How much did they award your father?
Well, here was the thing. The court ordered me to monitor the Army and the Civil Service Commission in working out the financial relief of remedial pay. It ordered me to oversee.
They put you in the driver's seat.
They put me in the driver's seat. And so we figured it out, and it finally came up to $100,000 that we accepted back pay, gave him four promotions from a GS-11 to a GS-14. But more important than that, the Supreme Court would later get the case, not us, because we settled ours before it got to the court. But the Supreme Court later would say, and that's in the book, if we'd have received Pettit, we'd have overturned it because presidents don't make law, Congress does. But what the court did was not only—
Excuse me, they didn't accept the premise of
executive order. Yeah. Being force of law, yeah. Even though Nixon was at that time arguing that very, very strongly because of what was happening in Vietnam and Laos and so and Cambodia. But anyway, we won the case. The case was settled. But it stood, the major proposition that it stood for then was if you prove that you were qualified in all other aspects, that— then the burden of proof would shift to the defense to come back and show that if it was for other reasons other than race that you were not promoted.
Well, here's my question. I mean, you listed a few examples of how your father was abused for his effort to get you into Aberdeen High School in 1959 and 60. How did you prove that he was looked over for promotions, that he was discriminated against in his job with the Army as a civilian?
Well, see, Mitchell
Juanita Jackson
had laid the foundation. She had had all of these administrative hearings where all of this was on the record. So for example, books that he would go to the Library of Congress and so forth wouldn't have his signature on it. Routing slips in terms of certain office procedures would not have his name would not be on there as an engineer. He would not have certain secretarial facilities. So as I said earlier, when he walked into his office, his supervisor had a lighter that would play Dixie when my father would go to ask about a promotion. He would come into work and a big rebel flag would be hanging in his office. They called him and the supervisor told him, said, George, you don't need a promotion. You don't have to live in the expensive neighborhoods that white people live in. You don't have to belong to a country club. You don't have to do this. You
and
don't
did these things
that.
Happen in 59, 60,
yeah,
61?
Yeah, the all
it,
these years.
And did it continue up until the 70s?
The same people were there. And so what the Court of Claims did was pull out these excerpts from the administrative records and, in fact, adopt these excerpts. It's a long opinion in the Federal Report has adopted these excerpts as to their findings of fact that George D. Pettit was discriminated against in retaliation for him integrating the schools.
Aberdeen High School.
Right. And so we've got gone full circle.
Before we go to this break, Dwight, I was wondering, what happened to the other black students in Harford County after you entered Aberdeen, those who were satisfied, their parents didn't want to join the case with you. They were at the consolidated schools.
Most of them were consolidated, but in 1967, I think, they abolished that stair-step integration plan, and Harford County was fully integrated.
You mean you didn't have to apply anymore?
You didn't have to apply. Black, whites, they closed the consolidated schools, the black schools, and everybody went to the same schools. But let me just say one other anecdote, if I may. Dan, when I would go to court, be it in the federal or the Civil Service Commission administrative hearings, after my father's case, I'd walk in the courtroom, and the judge would say, the rules of evidence and procedure are governed by Pettit versus the United States because that had become national law. And they would always look at me and say, Mr. Pettit, do you have any relationship with Pettit versus the United States? And I would always say, Pettit was my father and I was my father's lawyer.
Wow. George Pettit. And this is Dwight Pettit in the studio with us today. His book is Under Color of Law, a self-published book, really an interesting story, the story of an American family. Dwight Pettit, of course, prominent Baltimore attorney. Efforts for three, 4 decades now. And when we get back, we'll talk to him about his legal career. Short break here on Midday. Enjoying our conversation this hour with A. Dwight Pettit, a Baltimore attorney, learning things about him and about the state of Maryland that we didn't know before from his book, Under Color of Law, The Story of an American Family. Which I assume if people want to buy, your book is available on Amazon, right?
Amazon.com, yeah. Barnes & Noble, good. And the publisher itself, iUniverse.
Which is it?
iUniverse.
iUniverse, right. Mm-hmm. You talked about your father a lot, of course, because he's such a big part of this story. What about your mom?
My mom, praise the Lord, is still alive. She still lives in Aberdeen. In fact, next month she will be 88 years old. And she was the glue that held it all together, as I guess a lot of people say about strong mothers. Mm-hmm. She was just a very strong lady that dealt with a very volatile situation of what my father was going through and what I was going through. She was a beautician by trade. My father had helped her go to beauty school in North Carolina, A&T, and she did hair, and I used to hang out at the beauty parlors and so forth when I was growing up. And she was just a dynamic lady that was all and is still always there, and she's been tickled pink about the book coming out. And as you know, Dan, I have some great pictures with her and my father in the book.
Your dad died in 1992.
Yes,
George.
And
Pettit.
I promised him sort of when he was on his deathbed that I would tell our story. So it took me 12 years to do it, but I finally got it done.
The other person you mentioned in this story, Coach Jim Smith from Aberdeen High School, the football coach, what became of him?
He died about 2 years ago.
Was he a coach for a long time?
Oh, he was a legendary coach. In fact, I was invited years later to come out and say some words when he was inducted into the Harford County Football Hall of Fame or Athletic Hall of Fame. He was the perfect stereotype athletic coach. Tough-minded, handsome, as I said, former Marine, war hero. Just a tremendous man, tremendous family. And I even say, other than my father and my uncles, he became one of my role models. I just thought the world of him.
Did you stay in touch with your classmates from Aberdeen High School?
Oh, yes. In fact, I went to the 50th anniversary this summer. And it was about between the wives and so forth. I guess it was 60 or 65 of us there. And I had also put out on the web that the book was out. So a lot of them had read the book. And they were like, Dwight, we had no idea what you were going through.
Mm-hmm. But it sounds like they were pretty cool, generally speaking.
They were cool, but they didn't know the tensions that I was going through in terms of the stress of the administration, in terms of
the teachers,
in terms of the community, in terms of the police and being stopped because my father rewarded me with a fancy car and so forth. And you got to remember, Dan, we're talking about a situation where I'm a popular athlete and have friends and girls and dances and so forth. I couldn't go to those dances and dance with anybody. I was not going to put myself in any type of situation to embarrass my family since they had done so much for me or embarrass the black community. Mm-hmm. So it was just a lot of things. My father used to tell me all the time, Dwight, you got your friends, they're white kids, they can do certain things. You cannot do that, son. You cannot do what they do. If they're having a beer party, you got to watch what you do. You got to watch who's in your car. You can't just go out with the girls and hang out and at the drive-in. And so it was a bit, I was carrying a different burden. I was carrying the burden of a whole African-American community in Harford County.
You write in the book about running into a different kind of discrimination at Howard University when you showed up there and played football.
Well, I ran into something that I hadn't expected, and that is, your readers can't see this, but I'm light-complected. And I moved into a world that I didn't realize that we as a people were still going through a sort of discrimination thing within our own race as well. So having dealt with discrimination in the white community, I get to Howard University and I go out for football and they look at me and say, yellow boy, red boy, what you doing out here playing ball? You're supposed to be, this is a different world. You don't come down here playing ball. So I understood what was happening. But fortunately, I was a good athlete again, which sort of gave me the opportunity to move on then. And in fact, my college football name became very affectionately, I was named Bleach.
Bleach.
I caught a few passes and it became sort of an accepted entity on
so
the football team.
After a little while, it became a joke.
Yeah, I became affectionately known as Bleach. My 4 years at Howard.
One thing you note from your book here is, and from your own story, Dwight, you say one thing that promotes the social integration process faster than anything I've ever seen in American life is athletics.
Right. Well, if you go back to Jackie Robinson, if you go back to Jesse Owens, if you go back to Muhammad Ali, the barriers that these people broke, and I just don't have to talk about that. You can go back to the track star, I can't think of the right name, and Althea Gibson in tennis. These people broke barriers that would not have been broken had they not been accepted as athletes. And we find that...
Jesse Owens.
Yeah, Jesse
Owens. I'm sorry. I was trying to remember. I was reaching for his last name.
Yeah, Jesse
Owens. Jesse Owens, the 1936 right. Olympics, 38.
We go back yeah. to Jack Johnson.
Yeah.
You know, athletics broke down a lot of things. Maryland was one of the leading states here. In terms of integration of the Southern conferences. And we know now the history of Paul Bear Bryant when he began to recruit looking for black athletes at the University of Alabama, while George Wallace is saying no, the athletic programs were out recruiting yes. And see, I played football in a day then when it was really the black universities were segregated. We had tremendous stars in the black universities and the HBCUs. Morgan was a juggernaut. That could have played probably with anybody in the country. But we saw athletics gradually break down race in higher education, break down race nationally. And now we look at the National Football League, we look at the NBA, we look at baseball, and it's hard to even imagine that it wasn't that long ago when those were segregated occupations.
And what about the occupation of attorney and the legal profession that you stepped into after you got your law degree? Of course, you had Thurgood Marshall looming as this giant, right? In your own example, I mean, actually argued your case for you.
Oh yeah,
But what about the rest of that terrain? And you, Juanita Jackson Mitchell, we mentioned her.
Well, I had tremendous role models to look forward to in the profession. But as in the book, I ran into another obstacle when I attempted to come back to Maryland to practice law. The dean of my law school said, "Dwight, Maryland is a joke for black lawyers coming out of Howard." They were passing like one black lawyer at a time. And so I call...
You mean through the bar?
Through the bar. Yeah. So I call this the trilogy of litigation in my book because not only Pettit versus the Board of Education to allow me to go to school, Pettit versus the United States to protect my father from the retaliation, but then I file a third lawsuit, Pettit versus the Board of Law Examiners, to in fact bring litigation to the state of Maryland for segregation in terms of the Maryland bar.
Or discrimination in the
or
way,
discrimination
the
Maryland
way
bar.
The test was handled?
Well, my argument at that point in time is that they could identify who the black people were because you had to go through a personal interview before you took the exam. And they could identify you as, in fact, African-American. And so it was the first suit in the nation which tacked the bar exam in terms of going into U.S. Federal District Court. And my lawyers in that case was a man by Kenneth L. Johnson, who would become a circuit court judge.
Judge Johnson, yeah.
We go back to Jack Greenberg again. And a lady lawyer I'll come back to her name, but also was with the Legal Defense Fund. So again, I had another battery of national, Elaine Jones.
Elaine
I
Jones.
Had another battery of national lawyers.
Okay, so the argument there was we have a bar exam in Maryland, but it requires this personal interview.
Mm-hmm.
So that the results of the test are not blind. There's some
subjectivity. Exactly.
So opening the door for discrimination.
Exactly. And you got to remember, at that time, it was no multi-state bar exam. During the litigation, to offset the litigation, Maryland adopted the multi-state bar exam, and they abolished the pre-interview. The pre-exam interviews.
Did you establish that there was a pattern of discrimination?
Well, we used, I forget the name of the test that's used in litigation, but it's a test where you show the results. And we showed the results statistically that whites were passing at a ratio of something like overall passing rate of 80 to 90%. First time they were passing at 70%, blacks were passing at a rate of 5 to 6 to 7%. And it was like one at a time, really, except maybe for 1 year when they passed two or three blacks who were sort of politically prominent.
And these folks got to remember, these are young men and women who, or mostly men probably at the time, who have gone through law school and had a law degree and are sitting for the bar exam.
Right. And Maryland was just known, as several other states, that you had to take it several times to get through. And in that particular case, what eventually happened was that Judge Stanley Blair, who was a judge that I would appear before in the state of Maryland. Stanley Blair, you got it. When I passed the Maryland bar, I passed it. They say they passed me. When I did pass the Maryland bar, I was motioned out of the suit as the suit being moot because I had passed. So based on that, he granted a motion for summary judgment, so it never went to trial.
Okay, but it established a new...
It established that, first of all, they adopted the multi-state, and secondly, they had done away with the pre-identification opportunities of the pre-exam interview.
You decided to practice criminal law?
I decided to practice constitutional law, which criminal is a major part thereof.
I want to ask you about a couple of cases from years ago, because a couple of names popped out at me. So I want to just ask you about some of these cases. One was Turk Scott. I like, whenever I see this name, I think, gee, this is a remarkable story. This was a state delegate. His name was, I forget his first name, but he was known as James Scott,
yeah, mm-hmm.
known as Turk Scott,
mm-hmm.
who was a homicide victim in Baltimore.
Yeah.
I first heard about this case when I rented an apartment in the building in the where the parking garage was the location
Sutton
of
Plaza.
Was the location of his homicide.
Right, he was shot in the basement.
What was the case you later took up with regard to Turk Scott and the Sutton Place apartment?
Well, that case would go on to establish law in Maryland. I argued the case in the United States District Court in front of Judge Harvey, but then it was certified to the Court of Appeals for argument because there was no law in Maryland. The case eventually stood for the proposition that landlords had liability for apartments, facilities that they would rent, where they had known criminal activity. And so that established, in the first time in the history of Maryland, civil liability, where you knew that there was criminal activity had been demonstrated on the property, and the landlord failed to protect.
And it related to the Turk
and
Scott homicide?
Turk Scott, at that time, Turk Scott went on a criminal case. They charged the murderers of that case, Ken Johnson and Gerald Smith were the lawyers on the criminal side. But on the civil side was Michael Mitchell and I, and we established the cameras were out. The guards were off duty. All the security proceedings were down, and he was assassinated in the garage of Sutton Plaza. And the argument was that the landlord failed to provide the adequate security and all that they should have had.
And who did you bring that case on behalf of?
On behalf of his daughter.
His daughter.
Tina Scott, out of Washington, D.C.
Right. You also handled loads of criminal cases and represented the families of people who had been shot in Baltimore City, sometimes by the police. You've had all kinds of cases. You've been kind of all over the place.
We've been
criminal and civil.
Right,
cases.
We've been very, very fortunate. You know, I hate that the development of what has happened in terms of police brutality, that we have been flooded with those cases. That's something I see as a negative, even though as a lawyer we still take those cases, even though we're being flooded with calls, and that wasn't my intent to get into the area of police brutality. But I've had the very fortunate occasion to handle cases with Billy Murphy, who was very much into that area. We brought in Johnny Cochran on a couple of those cases. And a couple of those cases got not only local but national acclaim, because you might remember the Quarles case of a young man shot on television,
Lexington Market.
Mm-hmm. We had several cases that, I still do have several cases which are very notorious in terms of publicity, unfortunate as that might be.
There was another case. Was it the Larry Hubbard case?
Herbert was shot in the back of the head. That's the one I did with Billy Murphy and Johnny Cochran.
That was pretty bad. And then you had another case of a young man who, even you were surprised at the verdict in this case, a young man who was being chased by police.
Stinnett was one of the biggest criminal cases that I had in the case.
And that was one where even you expressed surprise at the outcome of that.
Well, because everything was observed. The police chased him. He ran allegedly intently over a police car, and I can't think of the officer's right name at this point in time.
Was that Garvin?
Gavin.
Gavin.
Officer Gavin.
Kevin Gavin.
Killing Kevin Gavin.
Yeah.
And the police were so emotional in that case, just like we saw this weekend with the killing. Wounding of the sergeant up in Northeast Baltimore. The police were so emotional in that particular case, they just did a very, very poor job of gathering the evidence. And so we were able to, I think the chapter of the book is called A Reasonable Doubt, Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. And we were able to chip away with that case in terms of failure to produce the proper evidence, failure to preserve the evidence, just different things that happened with the police department. Where the jury, I think, just got sick of the police making mistake after mistake after mistake.
A. Dwight Pettit, his book is Under Color of Law, The Story of an American Family, which really begins with this fascinating tale about the integration of Aberdeen High School in 1960 by the man in our studio, Dwight Pettit, who went on to have this long career as an attorney in Baltimore. It's great to have you on the show, Dwight.
Thank you so much for having me, Dan. And I hope people will look. Also, one of the things that we forgot to talk about was the Jimmy Carter part of the book.
Well, all the
and
politics
I know we can't get to all of it.
Well, it was all of it. I was just so fascinated by the Aberdeen
much.
Part of the story.
I appreciate it.
Really,
because
that's a kind of an untold story. So I appreciate you coming in to talk more about it. And folks can read about it in the book, which you can find on Amazon, Under Color of Law by A. Dwight Pettit, our guest in this hour of midday. Thank you, Dwight.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate being here.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Have a great afternoon.